on the conservative side of Democrats. So I actually think you might like it a little.
It's very rare for me to find someone who I like everything about. I usually pick somebody who I like two-thirds of. Not even three-fourths, but two-thirds.
Yes. Hi, and welcome to Mixed Identity. This is a podcast where I interview people who have more than one identity. I'm really starting this podcast by talking to people who have multiracial or multi-ethnic identities, but it's not going to stop there because everyone has multiple parts to their identity that goes beyond race. But I find every time I talk to a mixed race person, their story is so interesting, and most especially, and how I'm starting these podcasts, is talking to my siblings. There are five of us that are still here. And what I find interesting is that even though we were raised in the same family with the same parents and pretty much the same place, we all identify differently because of our interactions with the world, I think. So I find every story totally unique, but also totally relatable. So I feel like I should collect these stories for the rest of the world. And with that, I'm your host, Heather Puri. And as we talked about in episode one, I identify as a Tsimshian woman, though I have a father of Irish descent and a mother of mixed descent as well. And so now we're going to talk to my younger brother, not little, but younger brother, Paul Beal, and he is going to introduce himself a little. I'm going to first ask you, say hi, Paul.
Hey.
All right. Hello. So I want to ask you how you identify, and that you can say it can be racial, which is what we're talking about now, but it can also be other ways that you identify. But how do you, Paul Beal, identify?
I put it into three categories. I identify as Paul. I almost feel like when people really get to know you, I mean, there are parts of you that are labelable, if that's not a word, but that you can put a label on.
I like that word.
But I feel like when someone gets to know you well, they quit putting labels on you and you're just the person. So I identify as Paul.
I like that a lot.
And then I do identify as a Native American, but I always find myself not apologizing, but justifying that I'm Native American. Like whenever I tell a story about how I got a scholarship in college or you know, this or that, I will point to my forearms and I'll say, I know I don't look it, but I'm a quarter Native, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it was just a month ago I realized I'm the first generation raised off the reservation.
Yeah.
That didn't hit me till like a month ago. And then lastly, I'd say I identify as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, yeah, or what most people would call Mormon. That might come before my Native identification, actually.
Yeah, I would say so in your life, that comes first as a LDS member of the LDS Church. And then, so do you identify to others as Native, or do you tell people that you're Tsimshian?
Native. I tell them Native. Sometimes I'll say Alaskan Native, but that will most of the time just get questions if I'm Eskimo. Yeah. And I'll say, well, they're Inuit, and no, I'm further south. I'll say Washington. I'll say we're pretty darn close to Washington.
Yeah.
And people go, oh, okay.
I don't even think a lot of people know that part of Alaska is so close to Washington. Yeah. The southeast part where, you know, the capital is and that. I don't think a lot of people realize, like, when they look at the map. I had the funniest, and I can't remember who we were talking with. Was it one of your kids? No, it was Ruth's daughter, Anna. We were looking at a map of where Alaska was, and we looked at the globe, and Alaska's above. And she was like, no, 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 Alaska's below the 48 states.
Because she looks at it on the map. I'm thinking.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so really funny. But context, right? And things you learn about people and putting labels. But because the U.S. map always puts Alaska and Hawaii down below, she like thought Alaska and Hawaii were together. But you miss those, the Southeast Alaska part. I have people get confused when I say Alaska Native because they think I'm just from Alaska, which is not true. We're not from there. We didn't grow up on the reservation. We visited infrequently. But to go to my next question is how does the world identify you? And I'd like
I'm a white dude.
Yeah.
I'm 6'4". My skin is pale. I'm white, and that's why whenever I talk about being Native, I will say I know I don't look it, but I am. I feel like people may look at me. I can't even think of her name. The lady in politics who claimed to be like a
Elizabeth Warren.
Yes, I feel like people may look at me like that, and I'm like, no, really. Go meet my mom. Like, there's no mistaking that woman is Native. There's no mistaking my older brother is Native. You just don't think I am because I got more of my dad in me. So, genes wise.
Or you show more of your dad. Yeah, you're like a giant dad.
Yeah. My dad's gardener saw me from afar and he thought I was him. And then when he walked up, he realized I was much more bigger than him and has since decided to call me Little Joe. So yeah,
I like that. I like that. One thing I'd like to, so the world identifies you as white, but you have a very interesting, in your career choice, you are, can you tell people what you do real quick and then I'll make my comment on it.
Yeah. So I'm an adjuster. I work for an insurance company, and when people have car accidents, I pay all of the bills, so the cars too, but the bulk of what I do now is settle injury claims with people's attorneys when they're injured and were at fault.
Yeah, but most of your job takes place on the phone, and you...
All of it on the phone.
Yeah, all of it on the phone. People never see you. They don't get to see your 6'4", white-presenting self. But you're also a fluent Spanish speaker, and you use Spanish. Do you still use Spanish in your job a lot, or now that you're working with lawyers, not so much?
I do, and I can always, I love it, and I can always hear the relief in people's voice, because sometimes they'll call in, and they'll be like, do you have someone, and it'll be broken English, and they'll ask if someone speaks Spanish, and I'll be like, yeah, I speak Spanish, and I'll say it in Spanish. And half the time, they just say, oh, wonderful, and they start speaking Spanish. And the other half, they're like, no, habla español. I'm like, sí, estoy hablando, and I'll tell them in Spanish, I am speaking Spanish. And it takes them a little bit, and they're like, oh, you really do? And I'm like, yeah, I'm rusty, so be patient with me, But yeah, and a lot of them think I'm from Brazil because my accent has gotten horrible, but sometimes they think I'm from Argentina.
Do you feel that you don't have, so just to give a little background, where did you learn to speak Spanish fluently?
Yeah. So I went on a mission for my church, at 19. I went to Chile, in South America. As the plane was landing, I thought to myself, what in the world am I doing? and for the first 6 weeks, I spent all my time with a native Chilean. So it was, I had no one to speak English to, so I really, really had to learn Spanish. After about 6 months, I had become what I would call fluent. And yeah, so it's just stuck with me. And I think, like, so if you go down to South America, a lot of, I know it's not just Germans, but a lot of Germans ended up going to Argentina. And so I think that's why a lot of Chileans thought I was Argentinian, because I spoke good Spanish, but I was tall and white. Maybe I should say tall and fair skinned.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's where the people thought I might be from Argentina. But yeah, that's where I learned Spanish.
Yeah. And so the people, the Chilean people who you would interact with most often would actually not identify you as from the United States, but as Brazilian, or sorry, as Argentinian.
Yeah, the Brazilian didn't come till later. To me, you don't speak someone's language unless you have the same intonation, the same way of speaking, you know? Like, there's a guy I knew from South Carolina who went on a mission, also Spanish-speaking, but he spoke Spanish with literally a United States Southern accent. I can't even imitate it. It's... So, you know, to me, I didn't speak their language until I spoke it like they did. You know, not necessarily slang, but like putting verbs in the same spot, because you can do it in different ways. You know, you can sound English, you can sound American English, you can sound Canadian English, you know, so I tried to sound their Spanish. And so, yeah, they thought, since my Spanish was so good, I must not be from the States. And then when I got home, I didn't speak Spanish much for like 8 years, maybe 10. And I got a job selling insurance in Spanish, and I had lost my accent. And so I kind of, in trying to recuperate an accent, apparently made one that sounds Brazilian, which I was very proud of, because on the phone, they didn't immediately think, oh, this is a kid from the United States. You know, this is a gringo. They thought, oh, it's not his first language, but English isn't his first language. So, yeah, that's where the Brazilian came from.
And when you were interacting with people in your job, and when you spoke Spanish regularly, we talked about there's a sense of relief that they would have when, in your current role, when you start speaking Spanish and you're able to understand them. But how would you say that this has helped your... them thinking you're not a gringo, like, how has that affected your efficiency at work? That's a very MBA term. That's not what I want. But your effectiveness, like...
efficacy?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's good because... and I'm struggling with the right way to phrase this, but having left the United States... And seeing people's perspectives of the United States has formed a lot of my political views, because a good chunk of people don't like us. They don't like what we do. They don't like how we act on the world stage. In fact, while I was in Chile, 9/11 happened. And as a missionary, you try not to be much involved in news. You're there to spread the word of Jesus Christ, so you don't do much in news. And this one guy, I mean, we knew a little bit about it. We knew a lot of people that died, but that was kind of the extent of what I knew. And this one guy, you know, tried to throw in my face, you know, that you need to turn the other cheek. And you know, the small part of me said, well, I think we just turned like 4,000 cheeks by all the people that died. But the other part of me just said, oh, I'd love to talk with you about Jesus. So I feel like people, when they don't think of you as American, they're more willing to talk with you, which is bad, because we, at least to a lot of people, we have this stuck up, aggrandized version of who we are, and we think we're the best. And, you know, if you're the best, that means everybody else isn't as good as you, which, you know. Yeah. But
yeah.
I think it helps, because they don't think, oh, this guy's full of himself. You know, he's an American who speaks two languages and didn't deign to speak it like the rest of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to switch gears and talk about growing up, because I think it's very interesting. Where we grew up, and I would have to say you were probably the least observant sibling
yes.
that I have.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I, like, growing up, they will have heard a little bit of this from Ruth and I in our first episode, but we grew up in a very racially diverse area. And I just was wondering, you know, because I can even think back to, like, even in elementary school, like, I hung out with all the Filipinos. Like, that's, you know, there was definitely an understanding of race by the time I was in elementary school, and understanding that I didn't belong to any of them that were around us, that we were different, right? I wonder when you first understood or recognized that we came from a different family from those around us, even though it was very racially diverse, but a different family in the sense that, like, our mom and dad didn't look like each other. Can you remember when you first kind of had to acknowledge that, or not even the first time, but just, can you as a kid just remember kind of dealing with your mixed race identity and, like, how it affected you as a child, or did it?
I feel like I was ignorant of it, not in a bad way. At least I think it's not a bad way. Like, I recognize that where we grew up, you know, we grew up in Southern California. I mean, I had a friend named Ryan. He was Asian. I would not be able to tell you what part of Asia. A good friend, Janet Leung, I would guess Korean. A good friend, Jason Greenaway, he was Black. But, like, to me, that wasn't who they were. It was Ryan, Janet, and Jason. You know, they were people first, and where they came from, I was ignorant of and didn't care of, because they were people, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I ever had the thought or had to grapple with mom and dad have different skin tones. Mom and dad were mom and dad. You know, I kind of think of, it's like celebrity kids, you know. This isn't, I don't even know if Harrison Ford has kids, but, you know, if
Madonna,
he has kids.
We know Madonna has kids, right? Okay.
Oh, there you go. See, and I don't know which, I don't pay enough attention to him to know who has kids and who doesn't. But yeah, but so Madonna, like, Madonna's kids, Madonna is mom, you know, and that's who she is. And sure, maybe she had a career, maybe she made some money, but this is mom to them. Mm-hmm. At least I imagine that's what they think. That's what I hear a lot of them say when they, you know, I'll hear Jimmy Fallon or I'll hear Stephen Colbert ask them, like, do they know what you've done? Do they recognize what? And it makes me think of, you know, Jesus is teaching a prophet's never recognized in his own town, you know. Mm-hmm. So for me, mom and dad were mom and dad. That one was lighter skinned than the other didn't matter. They were mom and dad. I didn't even think of it.
All right.
I think the first time I thought of it is when you mentioned it here in this podcast.
Oh.
Like that it was something to be thought of. Oh. Never crossed my mind.
Well, I'm thinking, okay, so I want to see if you remember this story that mom has told before that has stuck with me, that you and her were shopping at Costco.
I do remember the story. I've told it, yeah.
Can you tell it then? Can you tell about this story? Which I find interesting that you didn't, even going through this experience. So share the experience with us.
Yeah, so we're, I thought it was a mall, but it might have been a Costco. Maybe. But we were out shopping. This is elementary school, so different friend, his name was Carl. He was Black, and, you know, we just ran into each other while we were shopping, and we started talking, and he was like, where's your mom? And I pointed to my mother, and I said, there's my mom. And he goes, well, she can't be your mom. And I'm like, no, this is my mom. And he's like, no, she's got dark skin. Like, she can't be your mom. And I'm like, at least now, the way I think of it, like, I don't know what to tell you, bud, but this is my mother. At the time, I think I probably was just like, what do you mean? I don't know. You know, I'm little 9-10-year-old, mm-hmm. not grasping what he's trying to say. Just like, this is mother. Like, she's always been there. This is mom.
Yeah. So that's, it's interesting that, like, you can go through those experiences and then be like, I haven't even thought about it being different. Like, it's not a concept. So I'm going to ask you a question, and I know that you have thought about this and you do think about this, which is white privilege and how it's affected you in your life and how you would say that you utilize your white privilege now.
Yeah, so I have thought about this one a lot because, you know, none of me wanted to be better off than someone else because of something I didn't do. And I mean that in that, I'm trying to figure out the best way to mean that. Like, I guess I wanted to be proud of what I accomplished, and what I've accomplished is all because of my work and my effort. You know, it has nothing to do with the color of my skin. But the more I thought about it, you know, the more I went, okay, so maybe I wasn't, at least for me in my life, maybe I wasn't put higher than others due to white privilege, but I wasn't put down. You know, I have read some studies of where the one that blows my mind is you send in the same resume with just different names, you know, one very Christian white names, you know, Matthew, I don't know, Brown, and then one with other Paul. Names. Yeah, one with Paul Beale, you know, and then you put another name in there that is obviously not a white name. And even though the resume is the same, the white name gets picked, you know, just statistically. So the way I've grappled with it is, well, I may not, and maybe I have, and maybe I'm unaware because I'm unaware of many things. I may not have been put up because of being white, but I certainly wasn't put down like other people around me who can't pass as white.
Yeah. Do you ever refer to yourself as white passing or white presenting?
Only in conversations with you. I hadn't thought of it, you know. Yeah. I mean, I guess the more we talk, the more I will. I also identify as white. So I guess there's four things I identify back to one of your first questions. Because that's what people see me as, so that's what I am. You know, perception is reality, so.
Yeah. How does our Simpson culture play out in your current life? You live far away from any large Simpson population, which is how we grew up most of our lives, is being, I like to say, I knew other Simpsons, but they were just my brothers and sisters. But how does your Simpson culture, how is it in your life now? How do you share it with your children? And just anything about that?
Yeah, so I'm in Arizona, and near one of the stories I'm thinking of how we get it into our lives. You know, I've told the kids we are. I've told them where we're from, told them grandma grew up on a reservation. I don't know if I may, or like when I was younger, I dreamed of going back to the reservation. I thought it would be cool. And mom was like, no, that's like a horrible life living on the reservation. You don't want to go there. But I think for the past 3 years, every year, the baseball, I can't think what they're called. The Diamondbacks, sorry. I'm a Dodgers fan, so I can't think of my rivals' names. The Diamondbacks will have a Native American night. And so mm-hmm. we go to the Native American night, you know, and they have a lot of tribes that come. They're all the Southwest tribes. So not necessarily my people, but I see them as my people because I think we're all related.
Yes.
And like, I had this moment of, wow, when I was sitting there during the Native American night, and this girl in this beautiful Native dress, you know, Southwest Native dress, sang the Star Spangled Banner. And I went, how crazy to me. This, I love the United States, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But they destroyed Native populations. And here mm-hmm. is this girl singing the anthem of the United States. And it got me to thinking. And I ended up asking mom about it. And I was like, what do you think of that, mom? Like, that this Native girl is singing, you know, and to mom anyways, the United States was so far away. Like, the United States didn't ruin her tribe. The Canadians did. But it didn't matter, you know, and I just went, how weird, you know. So, but, we'll show our kids this when we visit mom. We'll see the things. I'll tell them stories of how the ravens stole the moon, you know. So I pass on the stories I know, and I incorporate not necessarily their particular native culture, but native culture in general.
Yep.
You know, I tell them how their uncle made a totem pole in Washington, D.C. I took a picture when I visited our cousin Noah, who's also native, graduated from George Washington. And there's a totem pole there that I took a picture with, and I showed it to the kids. And I told them, you know, our uncle also made one in Knott's Berry Farm.
I didn't know David Boxley had one in Knott's Berry Farm.
He did. He does.
Oh,
yeah, it's still there.
I love Knott's Berry Farm. I really want to go back.
Yeah, so I try to make sure they know that, like, you know. And what's interesting to me is, you know, because I'm trying to pass on my heritage, they're also Mexican, because my wife is Mexican, and she's passing on her heritage, you know. And so they're these little kids who identify as Mexican and Native, but are as pale-skinned as me, you know, so.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to have Melissa on later, and we're going to talk about that. But it is interesting. We can talk a little about that, about sharing the different traditions of your, to your children, and how important it is. I find myself really, I think especially because for you and I, not by choice, but our Native ancestors, our grandmother, was, her culture was taken from her, and she had to go to, she was taken away from her family and put in a boarding school in Oregon, and, you know, beaten for speaking Shmaliok. And so the culture was, you know, it, I mean, even for our grandmother, it started with Andrew Jackson, who is a jerk, just, you know, to say that out loud, he just wanted to kill the Indian. All right. There was actually Pop Warner was a big, do you know the guy who started Pop Warner football? Do you know football started with the natives? Did you know that?
I did not know that. Maybe that's why I love it so much.
Yeah, you should. I'll send you another. If you can't tell, I'm making a podcast because I love podcasts. But I think it's Radiolab does the history of football. And it really started. And so in one of the residential schools, the Pop Warner, the guy who the like little kid football is named after, I believe, I hope I'm getting this right, was like organized football, and they'd play Yale, and they'd play like the Northeastern colleges in football, and it was violent. It was crazy violent, and they had like people would die on a regular basis.
I did know that. Like there was at least one time, maybe two, where the United States debated just forbidding the playing of football.
Yeah,
because it was so violent.
Yeah, and so what's really neat is that they had changed some rules, so it wasn't just that violent where you think of running, right? And the you know football better than me, but a play where people are just up against each other and trying to push through, that's running, right?
All like of them. The ball. You always have an offensive and defensive
yeah.
line.
But yeah. Instead of the forward throwing, do you know who started the forward throwing? The Native team.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I'm going to send you this podcast, and I will link it in on my webpage as well. It's just really interesting, the history of football. I listened to the whole podcast, and I don't even watch football anymore because I married a man from Southeast Asia. So I watch a lot of cricket and not a lot of football. Every once in a while, we watch some NFL on Sundays, but not. I know you are. I would say that's part of your identity as well as college football.
I would say college football. My wife refers to college football as the mistress. My mom will count down how many more weeks until Christmas. I count down how many more Saturdays without college football.
So how many more?
I think it's only,
talk a little to you about your religious identity and how that interacts with your identity as Simpson and as Native. So how do you so I will give a little bit, I think I'll get this right. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't been a practicing Mormon for a long time, or LD member of, they call them Mormons and we're okay with it back when I was still practicing. There's an, which I know they don't now, but so, the Book of Mormon is a testament of Jesus Christ from the people of this land. So, so natives, and I would say how being part of your identity being a people of this land, and the how does that work within for you within the Mormon Church, which at least in the U.S. is still a very, it's not a very white because of all the work you did in Chile, not you, but but a little bit of you, but it's but in the U.S. it's still predominantly white church that's message comes from Native people, but it's still how just I don't know. I have lots of thoughts. I did not leave as an angry member of the church. I have an issue with faith, which is why I don't have any religion, because when it comes to having any type of faith, I'm kind of like, yeah, really? So that's just me. So I'm not an angry Mormon, ex-Mormon. But yeah. How does that, I just think about that, like how when I tell people that my mom is a Simpson Mormon, they are like, how did that happen? But as you were raised in the church and our mom converted, but how do you balance those two? Do they conflict with each other in any way? How do you feel that those two identities work in your psyche, I guess?
Yeah, and I wish I'd, because I never like to paraphrase what I call scripture. You know, like if I'm going to read you a verse from the Bible or the Book of Mormon or Doctrine and Covenants, what I consider to be the Word of God, I like to get it right as opposed to paraphrase it.
I can put it on the website when I post this too.
Oh, okay. Because there are, and I'm going to not get it right enough, but there's a prophecy about how in the later days, in the latter days, like, you know, part of this people who was destroyed will come back. And so I see mom becoming a member of the church, myself becoming a member of the church. I see this as, well, I guess I was born to it. I guess I became one when I stayed with it as an adult.
Yeah.
You know, I see that as a fulfillment of prophecy, you know. So I didn't think of them. I mean, I did think of them as Native, but I didn't think of them as Native. And I'll tell you what I mean. So the story begins.
They being the Nephites and the Lamanites.
Yes. So they
the
being
people in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. So the Book of Mormon is about a family who left Jerusalem, and how they peopled the Americas. And so to me, I always thought of them of the House of Israel, you know, and whether you're Jewish or Christian or what have you, the House of Israel is very important. You know, this is a guy who got promises from God, and part of the promise is that, you know, his children would be blessed. So if you're from the House of Israel, you've got some good blessings, you know. And so to me, I did and didn't think of them as Native. For the most part, I thought of them as a branch from the House of Israel that came away from Jerusalem. But I also did, on my mission, grappled a little bit with one of the teachings, and I talked with my mission president about it. So on your mission, you have a designated area where you don't leave. You know, like there's, I'm going to get this wrong, maybe 80, maybe 120 missionaries who serve in this area. My area was called Viña del Mar, and it covered the fourth and fifth regions of Chile. You might think of them as states, but they're numbered, not different names.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I was in the cuarta and the quinta región, the fourth and fifth region. Maybe like counties, but to me, they were kind of like states. And so I never left the fourth or fifth region. And over that 120 group of missionaries in the fourth and fifth region, there's an older gentleman who's your president. And he decides where everybody goes, you know, decides when companionships change, because you're always going two by two. You know, you always see the missionaries with one other person with them. And I asked him, because I had our oral history, the history of the Tsimshian people, goes back earlier than 600 BC, which is uh-huh. when the Book of Mormon kind of begins. And earlier, and the church has since changed it, it used to be phrased that the people who, you know, so these people come from Jerusalem, they people the United States, well, the Americas, and then some of them die off, some of them don't, and then they fall away from their belief in Christ, and they are, the church used to say they are the principal ancestors of the Native Americans. Now, if you read the opening to the Book of Mormon, it talks about how, I don't remember how it phrases it, but it says like that they are a part of, you know, it doesn't say principal anymore. It took out the word principal.
Yeah. So it's saying the native groups here are multiple.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not just made up of, you know, historical Nephites and Lamanites from the Book of Mormon. But the reason I struggled with it is, so, you know, it said principal, and so I thought, okay. And then our history goes back more than 600 years, and the other story in the Book of Mormon is much older. Those people all died. Like, there was one survivor, and he died later.
And what is that book called again? In the and what are those people called? I forget. Esther? That's not right. That's
so the Book Bible. Of Esther, yes, covers it.
Oh. What? Look at that. No.
Hold on. Is it? I think it starts with an E.
It does start with the E. Yeah, and it's the other group. I didn't realize they all died out. Oh man, it's been a long time.
Oh yeah. But so that and even if, you know, even if you don't want to read the Book of Mormon as scripture, it's got some pretty cool stories. You know.
Yeah.
It is. Oh, Ether, not Ether. Esther, but Ether. Yes, Esther. You're right. Is Old Testament, I think. But Ether. Yeah. So it tells that some people who came over much earlier, and they literally died to the last man. One guy was left standing, and then he wandered the earth, and then ended up finding, you know, the group of Nephites and Lamanites, and died a few months later. So I mean, I went. And supposedly, the way the story goes in the Book of Mormon, they were all together. Nobody left. Nobody did anything. They all died. And I went, okay, I'm Native American. Supposedly, the principal ancestors of the Native Americans come from this book. But according to this book, they all died, the ones who were here before 600 BC. And so I brought that question to my mission president, and he goes, well, there's going to be people who don't want to be in war. There's going to be people who leave, you know. So maybe your group of people just said, yeah, we don't want to die to the last man. And I went, oh, that is such an easy, simple explanation, you know. Mm-hmm. I hope that in any culture there's going to be a group of pacifists, you know.
Yeah.
I've joked with my daughter that if her parentage has anything to do with this, she will be a huge pacifist. you know, because she'll say things, and I'll be like, oh, well, I think you're our child.
Yeah, well, it's like interesting. Her. Yeah, well, that's a good thing. But I've been reading the Tsimshian stories, the volumes, the books that Mom and Dad put together for the potlatch in BC that they gave us as well.
Yeah.
And Tsimshian nations. The nation of Tsimshians, they are quite violent, and yeah. And the Gitxlan tribe, which is our tribe, and the Raven clan, which is our tribe. I read this story, and they are just jerks, man. They, I was like, So this whole concept of, but maybe they started off as pacifists and it's not all parentage, but I read a great book that talks about how part of it is resources. So when resources are actually sparse and you need to work together as a community to survive, that there is less war, at least within your group.
I would have thought that would have gone the other way.
No, but when resources become more plentiful to the point where people can have more than they need, that's when you start to have hierarchy and you start to see like towns and cities and kingdoms. And I'm not getting it exactly right. And I can't remember the book. But I mean, there is like when resources and people are coming from outside, there is that, but when you have internal, so the Simpsons, which I've been learning in our dance group, I have a wonderful woman, Melissa, who is actually from the BC side, and she comes from Port Simpson, and I knew some of this, but the Simpson is a nation of many tribes, right, of many Simpson tribes. So we are the Gitland tribe and House of Gamsh in that. But they were not, even in the Simpson Nation, I always thought we just fought with Haidas and Tlingits, but we fought with ourselves as well. So it's just interesting. You should read, do you have those books still? Do you know the ones I'm talking about? I want to like republish them and put them out.
I know the ones you're talking about, but if I have them, I have no idea of where.
Oh, you should find them and read them to your kids. I'm trying to get them, but they're my 4 and almost 2-year-old are not into
not
books.
Not ready though. To listen.
Yeah. We are reading a wonderful book called Sweet Farts. It's a chapter book. So we're starting with that. It's about farting. So the 4-year-old's all about it.
A chapter book about farting.
Pretty much. Pretty much.
That's awesome. Because I have read a children's book that, you know, talked about how different animals fart and how meat eaters fart less but more stinky.
Yeah, but the boy in it is 8 or 9 years old, the main character, and so I say it's like Patrick, or actually I said it's like Davin, because Davin, which is our sister's, our nephew,
I've seen him more.
Yeah, well, he was just here and he says or Patrick.
Oh, so, there we go.
Yeah. He's definitely remembering. So is there anything else, like more along the multiple identities that you've talked about, those 4 of white and native and Paul and a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? That is just a mouthful.
It is, yes. So the church recently came out with guidelines of how the first time you should introduce it as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with its full name. Because the way we understand it, Christ himself revealed that to be the name of the church. And so you should use the name that Christ gave you. But then after doing it once, you can refer to it as the church or the LDS church. You can shorten it after the first time you mention it.
All right. Nice to have brand standards.
Yes. they definitely have someone in PR who's getting some brand standards.
Yes. But is there anything else you want to share with us before I kind of give you my last question of this? Because we're wrapping up about...
Yeah, I guess, you know, 2 other things I identify as is, you know, dad and husband. Although I don't think of myself as husband because my wife almost never calls me husband. It's more Beale or Paul or you. but, you know, those are a large, large part of my identity as well. You know, I am a dad. I guess that applies outside of my family to the extent that I can understand what other dads are doing. And it also, I guess, applies because I will see in media, you know, the way dads are portrayed, sometimes well, sometimes not. And I guess I get an inkling of what other people may feel when their culture is displayed a certain way or this or that, you know, because I will see the doofus dad on TV or in a book and I'm like, we're not all like this, you know, like some dads are really involved in their kids' lives. Mm-hmm. Some dads, you know, would do anything for their children, you know, little or small. And I think the little ones are tougher than the big, you know, I should have said big or little, not little or small. You know, so I get an inkling, I guess, of how other cultures, you know, or races may think, quit pegging me into a hole, you know, like,
yeah,
treat me like a person.
That's really thoughtful to take, like, what, because for you who are to the world for all purposes, like the one of the people with who is given or just not pushed down the way you say it as a white passing man, cisgender. I never know if I say that correctly or not. I'm still trying to get that, but it's harder for you to understand. So finding that one way of being able to relate to the doofus dad. I know I've been watching lots of Peppa Pig because I have a 4 and a 2-year-old. And that poor dad, man, he is like, they make fun of him because he's fat and like, it's not so nice. They're like not super nice to their dad. And you see that a lot in media. So that must be not fun to watch, but that's thoughtful to take that and being able to find, is empathy the right word for that? To find that empathy to...
I think it's empathetic, yeah, because... And believe you me, I don't think I really get what other people go through. I think I have an inkling of it, you know, like when I see the doofus dad, it irritates me for a little bit and then I move on with my life. It's not a systemic form of suppression, you know?
Yeah. Thank you. And that is like you're trying to find the little bit of empathy and understanding because I think for a lot of people, I would put our dad, who's probably going to listen to this, and I hope he's not super offended, but I think our dad has a hard time because parts of his identity, I mean, he worked, you know, our dad is, I like to say, is like literally the American dream. Like, he is a kid who grew up with like one pair of pants, and like, he grew up really, really poor. But he's also a white dude. So as he progressed, and I find this with myself as well, like as he progressed and as he was able to move up the ranks in the military and then get a college education and certain things, dad worked incredibly hard. You talked about this in the beginning. He worked incredibly hard to get where he was. And it's hard for him to see that there were certain barriers that he didn't have to push down that people who don't look like him have. And for you to just take the time to understand that is good. And I wonder if it's because there is, for you inside, part of you is not a cisgender white man that allows you to have that. Or if you're just, you know, a thoughtful dude who takes the time. You also have a wife who's probably made you.
what I hadn't thought before, my wife has made me think. Yeah. So I, you know, I grew up, like you mentioned early in the podcast, very ignorant of the world. Naive could be the right word too.
Naive is very, that's a good word. Yeah.
And I do recognize that, like, I think it was when I was 20, I went, holy crap, I can do anything I want in life, which makes me feel bad that I didn't do more with it. But like, you know, statistically speaking, if you're taller, you can be more successful in business. I'm 6'4". I'm white. I'm a male. Like, I came from a family, mom and dad had college degrees, you know.
Very first ones.
I had everything going for me, you know, like there. And the way I would look at it is, you know, I had no roads closed to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I could choose whatever path I wanted, you know, where if I had darker skin, you know, or a different name, or any number of things, roads are just closed. And if you know, I could see that for some people, they would go, well, I'll just take a different road. You know, I would have liked to go down that road, but I'll take this one over here. But there are other people who would say, no, that's the road I want. And it's mm-hmm. going to be a tough life for them. But, you know, they're going to make it better for people behind them, you know, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
But I had no roads closed to me, you know, so and maybe if I were to put more thought into it, maybe white privilege was indeed privilege, not just not closed roads, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So
or maybe it's a privilege to not have roads closed. You know,
yeah.
I guess we could look at it that way, too.
Yeah. There's all different ways. Ruth once gave the best analogy ever is that we're all going up a mountain, but we're all going up past behind people that were like us. So for white cisgender males, the path is well worn. In fact, they might have a train on their path, right? Like you could look at it like that. They might actually have a train. So if you sit in the caboose of the train, you're still going to get to the top of the mountain or close, and you don't have to put in a lot of effort. You can put in a lot of effort and get to the peak quicker and, you know, get a great retirement fund going or whatever. And then if you're like a black transgender female, right, or whatever, like one, there's not a lot of people who have made, so your path is not as clear. It's going through a very dense forest, and there might be a small path, but as more people like that go up, and so that might be the spectrum. And so we all have different paths going up this mountain, but some people are scaling an ice cliff that's never been broken down, and some people are on the back of the caboose. So it's not, you can put in a lot of effort and be very successful, but people on other paths can put in that same effort and not reach the same heights.
I really
like that analogy of what privilege is, and it's just that people have done it before you and you're following people like them.
I was definitely in the caboose. It took me 13 years to graduate from college. I have to think that if I wasn't a white dude, I couldn't have put in the effort that I did and been as successful as I was, now that I think about it out loud. Like, and I would like when I worked in one of my jobs before I got my degree, I would look around, you know, cause it was this call center floor, and I'm like, why am I about to get a better job than all of these people around me? This class is very easy. I'm putting in maybe 15 minutes a day. Is that really enough to differentiate me from my peers? You know, I had this mm-hmm. moment of going, mm-hmm. why am I deserving of this college degree? You know? So,
yeah. Yeah. And that's a whole nother conversation that we could have, but we are coming up on about an hour, which is what I want to keep these to, because I don't know if people are going to actually want to listen to my voice for that long, but I like to end with,
I'll tune in for mine.
Yeah. You actually have a very nice, I'm listening through headphones and I'm like, you have a very nice sounding voice.
I think I've had to train it because all I do is talk on the phone. But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. What is something, typically media, it doesn't have to be, but so it can be a television show, a YouTube clip thing. What is a YouTube called? It's not a show, but maybe it is a show, but a YouTube thing.
A video?
A YouTube video, a book that you're reading that is just really sparking joy. And I'll start with mine. I like to share what, and this is not particularly sparking joy, but it's really, really making me think. So after I share mine, you can share yours, Paul, but it's a book called Seven Fallen Feathers. And it is by Tanya Talaga, who is of Polish and indigenous descent. And it is a story of Thunder Bay, a city in Canada, in they don't call them states either, but Ottawa. And it is a really sad story. It just talks about, and it's continuing till today, it's about seven indigenous children who lost their lives when they left their home communities to go to school because their home communities don't have high school. So to stay at home, you have to, like, to stay on the reservation, you have to basically say, I'm going to have an eighth grade education, which we know is not a way to survive in our world right now. Or you have to go to the big city of Thunder Bay or other places. But Thunder Bay particularly, these schools are run by Native or Indigenous groups, but they're not well funded by the Canadian government. And these kids keep dying pretty much on the regular. And the police basically are like, oh, they drowned in the river. It was an accident. And there's no, and it just, it was really eye-opening to me because I have heard, you know, Justin Trudeau say things about, you know, taking care of the Indigenous people in Canada, and that they've actually acknowledged how horrible the residential schools were. They've said a lot of words that I've never heard anyone in our U.S. government say about treatment of Indigenous people, but they haven't done anything. They are just saying words, which is basically what this book points out. So I think it's an important read for everyone to understand because a lot of what Canada did, the U.S. did here. So they're almost mirror images of each other. But that's it's actually sparking rage. But it's making me really, really have to think about what our family went through, like our grandmother, and how that has affected our mother and affected us, and how it's not, and how it continues today for kids who weren't raised off the reservation, right? You said it earlier that the reservation is not a great place to be, but because we're underfunding investment in Indigenous children, it's continuing till this day. And you and I are lucky to have had a grandmother who said we're going to raise our kids off the reservation, and a mother and a father who really valued education. And just thinking of the steps, it's something like only 14% of all Indigenous people in the U.S. have a college degree. Like, how, like, I don't know, it's just making me really think about what can I do to make a difference in that, because you and I received privilege from our parents' hard work and our grandparents' hard work. So anyway, so what are you thinking about that, or what kind of media that you would like to consume or share with other people?
I'll do three quick hitters, because, and I kind of feel bad about mine, because, and I often feel bad about mine, because mine are almost always fiction. And so sometimes they'll make me think of the world and, you know, the shortcomings of it and how to make it better. But a lot of times my fiction is just an escape, you know, a story to be told, to be enjoyed. So the one that I'm just thoroughly enjoying, I'm rereading The Name of the Wind, book by Patrick Rothfuss. One of the absolute best books I've ever read on the face of the earth. It's just amazing, his storytelling. Anybody who's read it knows what I'm talking about. Anybody who hasn't read it, if you've ever considered fiction, you should read that book. Although you may hate me because it's a three-part series and the third book has not been published in over a decade. when he first came out, he said he'd written them all. They're going to be published one a year. And he published the first one, Name of the Wind. He published the second one, A Wise Man's Fear, just as good as Name of the Wind. A smidgen different, but just as good in my opinion. And The Doors of Stone, the third book, isn't maybe coming out in 2020. There's rumors, but there's always rumors that third book is coming out. But I love that book. Every once in a while as I'm reading, I'll be like, ooh, like something will, I'll know what's coming by what I'm reading. I'm like, oh, this next scene's coming up. I love that scene. And like every 20 pages, I'll be like, ooh, this next scene's coming up. I love that scene. So that, you know, Name of the Wind is just amazing. Last night, though, we binged 4 episodes of The Boys. It's on Amazon Prime. Made me think a little bit of Game of Thrones. So the idea of The Boys is it's superheroes commercialized. So there's a company that literally hires superheroes to go protect particular cities or particular things. And cities will pay them money to go protect their city. And, you know, so superheroes and capitalism mixing, and you can imagine the things that ensue. Makes me think of Game of Thrones, and I worry that I didn't watch too many episodes of Game of Thrones. I had read the books, and eventually, as I was reading the books, nobody I liked was alive anymore. So I quit reading the books.
That happened to me too.
I mean, I did like Jon Snow, and Jon Snow was still alive. I did like Arya, and Arya was still alive. But like, I felt like I was getting so little of them. And Jaime Lannister, he was coming awake. You know, he was, you know, and he had a horrible childhood. But so I worry that the Boys TV show on Amazon is going to be like the Game of Thrones. And there's going to be no one I can like. You know, it is good because it shows some horrible things that happen in the world. You know, there's workplace misconduct by a male towards a female. I'll leave it at that. You know, there's Melissa laughed at me because I, you know, there was one scene where, and I'm not giving anything away because it's in the trailer. One of the superheroes kills a guy's girlfriend. And the company is, you know, trying to give him a settlement and, you know, discussing with him how much it's worth. And I looked at Melissa and I was like, it's worth a whole heck of a lot more of that because this, this, and that. You know, thinking as an adjuster.
As an insurance adjuster. I was like, what are you talking? Oh, man.
I'm like, no, it's worth so much more money than that. You know, and then the last thing, so that one makes me think of the world and how to make a better. Name of the Wind just makes me happy. I'm also rewatching a TV show called The League. It was on FX.
It's on Netflix now, right?
It is. It follows a bunch of horrible people who are in a fantasy football league. And I knew they were horrible the first time I watched it. But like, I think that was maybe 7 years ago, but now that I've lived longer and I've seen like people's lives and in my own life, like I'm rewatching it now and I'm going, oh dude, that's a horrible relationship. That guy needs to leave that woman. She is so not good for him. Like I'm just like I kind of knew it was an abusive relationship the first time I watched it, but it was abusive and it was funny, which is horrible. You know, abuse shouldn't be funny, but that was the level of understanding I had gotten the first time I watched it. And the second time I watched it, I'm like, ah, go away. Run away from that woman so fast. You do not need to be in that relationship.
I will put links when this episode does come out to all the media that we're talking about. And I want to thank you so much for your time, Paul. Plus, we should just talk more because, you know, it's nice.
Yeah.
And so I want to thank the listeners for joining us for episode 2. Please tune in next week for our next episode. And in the meantime, you can go to identitymixed.com or you can find us on all the social medias at @identity_mixed. And this is Heather Puri signing off for Mixed Identity. And again, thank you, Paul, for joining us today.
Glad to. Thanks for having me on.
Our theme music is Ice Flow by Kevin McLeod, licensed by Creative Commons. It can be found at filmmusic.io or incomtech.com.